Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Yaroslav Trofimov. Yaroslav is the Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting for two consecutive years, in 2022 and 2023. He has reported from most major conflicts of the past two decades, serving as the Journal's Bureau Chief in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and as a correspondent in Iraq. He's the author of several books, including Faith at War, The Siege of Mecca, and most recently, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. And that is the topic of today's conversation. This really serves as a primer on the war in Ukraine. We discuss the widespread false assumptions that Russia would win a swift victory, Ukrainian attitudes toward Russia, the transformation of the Ukrainian military, Russian incompetence, Russian public opinion, the Azov Battalion and the so-called denazification of Ukraine, the role of the Orthodox Church in Russia, conspiracy thinking and Russian propaganda, Putin's popularity on the right, NATO membership of Ukraine as an alleged provocation, the Minsk II agreement, alleged failures of Western diplomacy, Zelensky's leadership, the moral clarity of this war, Russian war crimes, the new cult of World War II victory in Russia, the numbers of casualties and displaced people in Ukraine, the delay of U.S. aid, nuclear blackmail, the significance of long-range weaponry, the weakness of Western sanctions against Russia, the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, and finally, how this war might end. And now I bring you Yaroslav Trofimov. I am here with Yaroslav Trofimov. Yaroslav, was that close to the pronunciation of your name?
That is perfect.
Yeah, nice. You've written a truly gripping and harrowing book about the beginning of the war in Ukraine, and I'd love to discuss that and really take us all the way through the present and into the future, insofar as we can foresee it. Before we jump in, what's your background as a journalist? What kinds of things have you covered beyond the war?
Well, thank you so much. You know, I was born in Ukraine, but this is really the first time I've come back to write about it. I spent the entire career that I've had at the Wall Street Journal since 1999 covering other people's wars and other people's miseries. Mm. You know, I used to be our Kabul-based bureau chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan for 5 years. I covered the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and then again, the war against ISIS, Islamic State, in 2015-16, and plenty of other wars, you know, Somalia, Libya, you name it, and the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. So my job as chief foreign affairs correspondent in the Journal, but a lot of the time was the Wars and Mayhem correspondent.
Yeah. Well, it is courageous work, as anyone listening to this conversation or reading your book will quickly intuit. Again, the book is Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. And so let's start pretty much where you start with your book. We're 2 years in, just over 2 years into the war, and I do want to cover events beyond those covered in your book. But the beginning of the war was astonishing for a few reasons. I mean, one was just that Russia thought that it would take just 10 days or something to accomplish. I mean, they thought they would take Kyiv in 3 days and maybe the rest of Ukraine in something like 6 weeks. What do you make of the level of delusion that seems to have kind of shrouded the launch of the war? I mean, what mistakes did Putin make, and how do you account for kind of the poverty of his understanding of what awaited him in Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I think the delusion was not just in Moscow. There was also delusion in Washington and in European capitals, because everyone, except the Ukrainians, was expecting Ukraine to fold in a matter of days. And I think it goes, first of all, to the profound misunderstanding of Ukrainian society and how much it has changed, especially since the war really began in 2014 with the initial Russian invasion of Crimea and the proxy war that Russia fomented in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. And back then, you know, the Ukrainian army was pretty much non-existent and couldn't put up much of a fight. And it was the volunteer units, ordinary civilians, who picked up guns and tried to stop the Russian little green men, you know, the Russian troops, who were not wearing uniform, but were in fact, you know, Russian service members in the battlefields of Donbas. And at the time, you know, Russia was not unpopular in many parts of Ukraine, because before that invasion, before that, you know, the first attempt to annex large parts of Ukraine, Russia was seen by Ukrainians as a country with higher wages, job opportunities, maybe less corruption. Volodymyr Zelensky at the time was working in Moscow. He actually hosted the New Year's morning show on January 1st, 2014, at the time when the Maidan Revolution was already underway in Kyiv. But after that, you know, every Ukrainian saw what this quote-unquote Russian world that Putin wanted to bring to Ukraine means. You know, the 8 years of occupation of Donetsk and Luhansk by Russian forces was this experiment. And people saw that Russian rule meant the collapse of law and order, gangsters taking over, taking properties at gunpoint, jobs disappearing, and more than half the population of Russian-occupied Donetsk and Luhansk voted with their feet. They escaped to the rest of Ukraine, to the west, to Russia. And so by the time Putin invaded again with this full-scale invasion in February 2022, every Ukrainian knew what it means to live under Russian rule. The cities of eastern Ukraine had hundreds of thousands of refugees from Russian rule. And I think this transformation of the Ukrainian society is something that went unnoticed in Moscow and in the West, as did the transformation of the Ukrainian military, which, you know, by 2022 became a combat-tested professional fighting force that underwent reforms and had hundreds of thousands of either full-time service members or reservists with considerable combat experience fighting the Russians.
So are you saying that in 2014, something like a majority of Ukrainians would have been sympathetic to being reabsorbed by Russia?
Not a majority, but of Ukrainians for sure. But a significant proportion of people in places like Kharkiv and Odessa, especially the older generation who sort of still lived in the Soviet, post-Soviet nostalgia. Yeah, and you know, I'm quoting in the book one of the sort of Ukrainian veterans who played a key role in the defense of Ukraine both in 2014 and in after 2022, who is saying that 2014, the majority of people in Kharkiv had this sort of latent pro-Russian tendencies. But that completely flipped. And as we saw in 2022, was virtually no support for the Russians. And the population of eastern Ukraine, you know, joined the military, fought to protect their cities, and did all they could to stop the Russians.
Well, so there was clearly a misunderstanding of Ukrainian sentiment and the likelihood that Ukrainian society would resist or acquiesce. But it seems also that Putin and perhaps his generals, and one doesn't know how far down the hierarchy this must have gone, but it seems that the Russians misunderstood the competence of their own forces, right? I mean, you know, you would expect, I think you would have expected that with or without Ukrainian resistance, just given the asymmetry in power, or what we imagine the asymmetry in power to be, that Russia still should have just rolled into Kyiv fairly quickly. To what do you attribute the early signs of incompetence on the part of the Russian forces?
Well, you know, there's a culture of fear in Russia, which also means a culture of lying. So people are afraid to report up the chain of command the problems that they have. And so everything gets embellished the higher up it goes. And, you know, I was speaking to General Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, and he was telling me that, you know, the Americans came to us and they had the intelligence, which they had from the highest levels. So they knew what the Russian generals were telling Putin. But we knew from our sources lower down the food chain that the generals were lying to Putin about the readiness of Russian forces. We knew about the corruption. We knew about the, you know, the equipment that wasn't functioning, the units that were only on paper ready, but weren't actually ready. And in fact, it all came into play. So the Russian army was not up to the task. But the other flip side of it also is because Putin lived in his own world in which he convinced himself that the Russians and Ukrainians are one people, as he wrote in his famous essay on history several months before the war. And the entire war plan only made sense on the premise that the Ukrainian army would not really resist. And that the Ukrainians would welcome the Russians as liberators from this Western imposed clique, which was thinking in the Kremlin, it appears. And so if you look at the Russian forces that were streaming towards Kyiv and Kharkiv, they were carrying parade uniforms. They were really expecting to be celebrating within days.
So can you say more about Putin's view of Ukrainian and Russian history? I mean, how accurate or inaccurate were his claims that he's made in that essay you cite and in various speeches? And to what degree does his view pervade Russia as a whole? I mean, do we know enough about Russian sentiment with respect to history and the war to know how much people share Putin's view, or is it another instance where public opinion really can't be properly assessed given the level of fear in the society?
Well, I think what we can say is that this view really is not exceptional. And we have to go back to the very foundational myth of Russia. So Russia traces its glory and its greatness to the Kiev Rus, which was a state established in Kiev by, you know, Princess Volodymyr, after whom Zelensky and Putin are named, and, you know, Yaroslav, after whom I'm named, and who ruled in the 10th, 11th centuries, well before Moscow even existed as a town. And so in the Russian historical narrative, that is the narrative of the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union, you know, Moscow is a direct descendant who has the legacy of that Kievan Rus and the historical right to rule all the lands once ruled from Kiev. Obviously, Ukrainians see Kiev Rus, because it's in Kiev, as their own heritage. And the Russian narrative has a problem, because you cannot trace your roots to the capital of another country, of a foreign country. And so the very existence of an independent, separate Ukraine completely undermines Russia's narrative, a view of itself. And so there was always a hostility to the very idea of a Ukrainian separate identity. Mm. Now, Putin famously said in the recent interview that, you know, Ukrainian language was invented by the Austro-Hungarian General Staff, you know, before World War I, which is complete nonsense, because there were, you know, centuries of literature in Ukrainian before that, even when it was banned by the Russian authorities specifically. And so we have a tradition of Russian luminaries, even the liberal ones, kind of believing the same things. You know, Joseph Brodsky, you know, the famous Russian dissident poet, who was exiled to America, you know, became the poet laureate of the United States. He famously wrote a poem on independence of Ukraine in 1991, saying, "I want to spit into the Dnipro River, and I wish it would flow backwards." And then he used a pretty derogatory name for Ukrainians. Mm. Unfortunately, that is part of the Russian mindset that is fostered by Russian education, which has never been decolonized. You know, everybody knows about the greatness of Pushkin or Dostoevsky, but we've never looked at them through the same lens through which we look at, for example, Kipling, because they're all, you know, pretty imperialist and pretty aggressively imperialist in their writings. And Ukraine is the centerpiece of that.
Where does Tolstoy come out in his writings?
Well, Tolstoy, you know, was more of a pacifist, obviously, and having seen war in the Caucasus and the horrors of war. But during his time, you know, the Ukrainian language was officially non-existent, and Ukraine was called Little Russia in Russian documents and literature.
What do you make, or what are we to make of the claims of denazification in Ukraine that Putin has said is part of the purpose of the war? And, you know, as spurious as those almost certainly are, given that Zelensky is Jewish and, you know, this sounds like an SNL sketch more than anything else. What about the Azov battalion and the historical links between it and various Nazi groups? Which is this is some version of a half-truth that is, you know, in the main ridiculous and cynical on the part of Putin, I have to think. But can you untangle this for us?
Sure, yeah. I mean, let's first go back to what does it mean to be a Nazi in Russian official lexicon. It's pretty much anybody who opposes the government or Russia is a Nazi by definition. This is their definition of a Nazi. Mm. And this comes at the time when, you know, it's forbidden to mention in Russia that the Soviet Union was a co-belligerent with the Nazis in the first third of World War II, you know, invading Poland together in 1939, right, and kind of being on the same side until June 1941. Now, as for the Azov battalion, which then became a regiment, you know, in 2014, when the Ukrainian army unraveled, you know, all these volunteer formations were created to try to stop the front line. And there were a lot of far-right extremists and soccer hooligans and all kinds of other unsavory characters who have flocked to groups like Azov. But since then, it has changed. Since then, it became a professional unit of the Ukrainian armed forces. The professional military officer, you know, Denis Prokopenko, became its chief ahead of the 2022. And it certainly repudiated, you know, any far-right ideology. You know, it declared when the war began that, you know, we have Jewish and Muslim members in our ranks, and we firmly reject the ideology of communism and of Nazism, the two ideologies that have caused so many millions of deaths in Ukraine. And if we look at the, you know, the electoral history of Ukraine, you know, yes, it has far-right parties, you know, one would even say neo-Nazi parties, maybe, but none of them have ever managed to get more than 1% of the vote, which is a lot less than in pretty much every other European country, I would think.
What is the role of the Orthodox Church in Russia in supporting the war, if any?
Well, you know, the Patriarch Kirill, you know, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, has come out very strongly in favor of the war. I mean, he declared it to be a holy war. You know, Russian Orthodox priests are blessing the weapons of the Russian troops, which is kind of remarkable considering that, you know, these are the weapons that are killing, you know, thousands of fellow Orthodox civilians.
Is there any explicitly religious framing of the war on the part of Putin or most Russians? I mean, is there some kind of, beyond the history in the sense that Ukraine isn't a nation and its existence as a separate nation is a perpetual insult to Russia, is there a religious, spiritual, you know, apocalyptic framing of it, or is just the church just a supporter on the sidelines?
Well, I think the church is not just a supporter. The church is an instrument of state power in Russia and has always been, you know, subordinate to state power. And a lot of the clergy in Soviet times were also KGB officers. And, you know, it's working very closely with the military right now. You know, Putin himself, you know, doesn't speak much about religiosity. And, you know, he was asked in a recent interview, you know, does he believe in God? And he didn't say so. But certainly the regime is playing this card of, you know, defender of traditional values. You know, there's whole crusade against, you know, gay, lesbian, and transgender rights. And it's part of its instrument of messages that it's sending out. And in the Russian official narrative, you know, Ukraine is taken over by satanists. You know, who want to force everyone to become homosexual and, you know, and every child to change the gender and all that. So, you know, the propaganda can be quite ridiculous.
The ridiculousness of it is, I mean, there are analogs to this craziness in other countries. And even in America, you have something like QAnon, where it's hard to believe that anyone actually believes what they say they believe. I mean, in the case of QAnon, you've got this imagined cult of pedophile cannibals that includes some of the most famous people in Hollywood and in democratic politics. So, you know, it's literally imagined, or at least it's alleged to be imagined by seemingly millions of people, that you have, you know, celebrities like Tom Hanks and you know, Michelle Obama and et cetera, drinking the blood of children so as to stay youthful. I think they're taking some magical substance, adrenochrome, out of the bodies of children. And perhaps additionally raping and cannibalizing them. And this is, it's a strange performance of, I mean, it's a kind of pornography of suspicion that gets amplified on social media. Yeah, but much of it does appear to be in earnest. How much of the conspiracy thinking that exists in Russia do you think is believed? And how much of it is just, we know that on some level we can't trust information, and so because there's so much propaganda, there's so much lying, there's so many half-truths, we're basically declaring epistemological bankruptcy, and we'll just entertain any string of sentences that anyone wants to produce.
Well, I think you have a point here. I think the main strategic goal of Russian propaganda is the removal of truth as a concept. So they're throwing out a whole variety of competing storylines that are incompatible with each other and seeing sort of what sticks. But the ultimate overarching goal is to foster cynicism and make people believe that, you know, there's no right and wrong and there is no true or untrue.
What do you make of the fact that Putin now appears to be some kind of hero of right-wing populists in the U.S. and elsewhere? I mean, he's the face of many things. I mean, he's the antithesis of the woke elitist who, you know, not to say Satanist, who's trying to turn your kid gay or trans. But he's also, I guess, primarily he's the face of anti-globalism on some level. How has this happened? I mean, you would think that Republicans in the U.S. above more or less anyone would have recognized that Putin is antithetical to more or less everything America thought it represented in the world. Again, right of center, even more than left of center. How did we get here where Putin is just celebrated without much of a qualm, it seems?
I think it's really interesting to see this and also the dynamic of this in America and in Europe. Because we're sort of on the same page with parts of the Republican Party in the U.S. and much of the European far right before the full-scale invasion. Putin was celebrated as sort of virile, macho man who is, you know, standing up for tradition against the woke and is defending, you know, the old truth. And, you know, because of all these different messages to different audiences, he could appeal both to, you know, some on the far left, but also some on the far right. And, you know, the propaganda was tailored. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened after 2022 in Europe is that Ukraine became a very real thing. You know, Ukraine in America is this sort of imaginary abstract construct that doesn't factor into daily life. But in Europe, after several million Ukrainians arrived, most of women and children fleeing the war, and it became a factor of daily life, it became very difficult for the far-right parties to openly support Putin. And so if you look at the, you know, in Italy, for example, you know, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, whose party, you know, used to be quite pro-Russian and whose deputy prime minister, Salvini, was very much pro-Russian, used to wear a Putin t-shirt, you know, they are now one of the most active and clear supporters of Ukraine. You know, you see the same transformation in many other countries, even in France, you know, Marine Le Pen and no longer openly supports Putin. But in the U.S., you've seen the opposite. You know, in the U.S., you know, we have seen that the Putin messaging is being repeated more and more, you know, including by members of the House and the Senate. And, you know, somehow Putin seems to have a hold on the mind of many parts of the American electorate at a time when Russia has absolutely no economic leverage over America. A big difference from Europe, which has had to pay a very heavy price for severing its energy dependence and actually would have a lot to gain from appeasing Russia, but doesn't.
How has the Wall Street Journal done editorially on this?
Well, you know, I work for the news side, so I can only speak of the news side.
Yeah.
And as a news site, we have invested a lot of effort into covering Ukraine, blow by blow. And I think, you know, as much or more than any other publication, because our readers care very much about what's happening there. And you know, everybody knows, you know, obviously everybody wants to know the detailed ground truth of what is actually transpiring on the front lines and in the Ukrainian society, because, you know, I think people realize just how much it matters. Despite all the sort of noise and proclamations that it's not our war, I mean, the fact is that after, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars spent by the U.S. and European allies and all the proclamations that we will stand with Ukraine as long as it takes, you know, you can say it's not our war, but a Russian victory in Ukraine will be seen as an American defeat by everybody else in the world.
Hmm. Well, what do you make of the apparent confusion on that point in America? I'm thinking mostly right of center. I mean, maybe there's a left-wing version of, you know, a similar confusion and a spirit of isolationism. But, you know, as I look right of center, I often encounter the claim that the U.S. and the EU are, to some considerable degree, culpable for Putin's invasion, right? I mean, it's often described as the result of Western provocations. You know, we crossed one of his red lines, which we knew to be a red line. There are failures of Western diplomacy, for which America, above all, is culpable. you know, did the prospect of NATO membership for Ukraine force Putin's hand here? I mean, how do you view this allegation that it's basically the war is our fault and Putin is acting as we would under similar circumstances, and you know, it's just we just failed to understand our adversary and, you know, what really mattered to him. And, you know, it's largely on us that we're in this situation.
Yeah, it's really strange to watch that exercise and, you know, trying to exculpate the guilty party by finding flaws in yourself. And, you know, if we go back to the Tucker Carlson interview with Putin, you know, he asked him repeatedly, you know, was it NATO's fault? Putin's response for half an hour was, well, actually, you know, Ukraine is Russia. And let me tell you the story of how since Volodymyr the Great and Yaroslav the Wise, it was always Russia. You know, NATO membership was not something that was happening. In 2008, there was a declaration at the summit in Romania that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. And that was the end of it. There was no membership plan, no negotiations, nothing practical happening. It's not like Ukraine was about to join NATO or was even negotiating to join NATO. It was just empty words. So there was really not much for Putin to fear from that, if he was really fearing that. And he wasn't, you know, because again, it's if you look at his mindset, you know, he has said famously that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. The greatest tragedy, worse than the Holocaust. And he was working very hard to reverse that tragedy and to collect Russian lands once again. That was it. It's just pure imperialist land grab.
What happened at the Minsk II agreement?
Yeah, so in 2014, when Russia fomented the armed uprising in Donbass, you know, it was started by an officer in the Russian intelligence service, FSB, Igor Girkin, who has been sentenced by a court in the Netherlands since then for his key role in downing a Malaysian Airlines jet in which hundreds of people died. Russia more and more overtly was sending troops to Donbass. And there was one agreement, the Minsk One. It failed because Russia decided to take more land and send tank units. And then as Ukrainian troops were being surrounded, talks began in Minsk again, sponsored by Germany and France and between Russia and Ukraine. And with a gun to its head, Ukraine agreed to the ceasefire, which stopped violence for now. And so as part of the agreement, you know, there were several conditions, and it started with, you know, Russia withdraws all its forces, restores Ukrainian control over the border crossings, then there will be elections in these areas, and then eventually Ukraine will change its constitution to accommodate autonomy and a certain role for the elected authorities of Donbass in the future running of Ukraine. What Russia said after this was done was that, well, actually, you know, we're not going to withdraw our forces. We're not going to allow you to reclaim the border. We will just demand that you change your constitution to give us veto power over your foreign policy through our proxies in Donbass. And that was the stalemate for the following 8 years.
Mm.
And obviously, you know, Ukraine, you know, was not going to give veto power over its foreign policy to people that Russia installed a gunpoint in Donbass and controlled 100%.
I think I've heard this, the failure of Minsk II described as yet another failure of Western diplomacy, or worse, that the U.S. and the U.K. just dismantled it for their own reasons, whatever those are.
Well, you know, let's go back to 2014 and 2015, January 2015. At the time, nobody was interested in helping Ukraine. President Obama at the time famously said, in an interview with the Atlantic, that no matter, there's nothing the U.S. can do to prevent Russia from dominating Ukraine. He washed his hands of Ukraine. No lethal aid was forthcoming. And everybody was really eager to do business with Moscow. You know, the U.S. was focused on the nuclear deal with Iran. The Germans wanted to do the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, you know, have lots of cheap Russian gas. And so Ukraine, you know, was basically left to its own devices. Having lost, you know, 14,000 people died in that war at the time. It's not a small number. And you know, everybody had a pause. Russia had a pause to, you know, prepare a full-scale war. And Ukraine had the pause to also prepare for a full-scale war that happened. But I think everybody was cognizant that Minsk was just a reprieve and there will be a next round, which is why the Ukrainians are very reluctant sign on to another deal with Russia that would leave Russia in control of Ukrainian land, because that would just mean giving Russian time to prepare for another round in which they could be more successful than this time around.
So take me back to the beginning of the war and the, I want to ask you about the emergence of Zelensky as really a hero here. And I'm wondering, what can you say about him? Is it appropriate to view him just as a hero? Is he a more complicated figure? How do you view Zelensky and his leadership from the beginning of the war?
Yeah, obviously, no. Every person is complicated, and every person has many shades of black or white or gray. Zelensky was very popular when he was elected in 2019. He got 3/4 of the vote, the highest vote in the history of Ukrainian elections. And he was not very popular by the time the invasion happened. What he did do is stay. And I was in Afghanistan in the summer, in August 2021, and I remember very well how one morning President Ashraf Ghani walked the ramparts of Kabul and said, you know, we will fight and defend the city. And by lunchtime the next day, on August 15th, he was in a helicopter to Abu Dhabi, and the Taliban were in my hotel.
Yeah.
Zelensky had the same option. You know, Boris Johnson, among other leaders, called him and said, on the morning of the invasion, you know, come to London, set up a government in exile like the Poles did in 1939. But he didn't. And I think that the heroic decision to stay and come out in the open and record this video address with his closest aides saying, we are here, we are staying, everybody's staying, we will fight, was a very important moment. And I'm writing the book about how the next morning I was driving through Kyiv and seeing hundreds of young men and women coming out of their high rises and going to a stadium to pick up weapons and head off to the front line on the city's outskirts to stop this advancing thousands of Russian troops. But, you know, he's human. He, like everybody else, has made mistakes. And there are plenty of Ukrainians who are not happy with all of his decisions. But the fact is that he's legitimately elected. He's the president. And he represents the continuation and legitimacy of the Ukrainian state. And so I think there is sort of unspoken consensus among many Ukrainians to defer criticism of his actions, especially before the war, to a time after the war ends. And, you know, will he be reelected in the next elections? Who knows? The Ukrainians, he's the sixth president of Ukraine since independence in 1991, only one of the six won re-election. So Ukrainians don't really like to reelect their incumbents.
So your book covers the war from its outset. I mean, you were there when it began, and I forget when your coverage ends. Is it through the first year of the war?
Yeah, so but the book really begins the day before the full-scale invasion, you know, when I went to see Zelensky's predecessor, President Poroshenko, who leaned towards me and whispered into my ear, you know, it's going to be tomorrow at 4 a.m. You have time to go to the airport and get out of the country. And lots of people did. Obviously, I didn't, because I had come there for the war. And it ends, the blow-by-blow travel through the front lines and detailed kind of descriptions of all the pivotal turns of the war, ends on the one-year anniversary of the war in February 2023, you know, where Zelensky is having this three-hour press conference. And the words that he said that really stuck in my mind, that, you know, we've learned a very painful lesson here. It may be unfair, but nobody likes losers, so we have to be winners. And then there is a little, well, not little, but there is an afterword that kind of takes us all the way to the Israeli war in Gaza in October 2023.
So how would you compare the war to other wars you've covered, both in the kinds of atrocities, the rightness or wrongness of, you know, tactics, the implications for neighboring countries? I mean, as you say, in America, Ukraine is not often thought about, and I would say it's not often thought about even in the midst of, you know, what is the first proper land war in Europe since World War II. It is really an afterthought. And to say that most Americans can't find Ukraine on a map is bound to be an understatement. How do you view its significance? And just, you were there and you've reported directly on other wars. What should we understand about what the Russians have done, what the Ukrainians have had to do? What, just give us some detail as to how you view this war.
Yeah, well, actually, I kind of want to go back to what you were asking about Zelensky and his achievements. And I think his biggest achievement was that because he was a showman, he is from the world of entertainment, he was able to speak directly to the publics in the West, in America, and in Europe, over the heads of politicians, and make the moral case for Ukraine. And you know, it is a conflict for me, but I think for lots of other people, that has the biggest moral clarity since the Second World War. You know, it's very black and white. You know, Ukraine wasn't threatening anyone, wasn't doing anything bad to Russia, and the Russian military invaded with all its might and flattened its cities and killed tens of thousands for no reason, except imperial dreams and nostalgia for, you know, the glories of the past of one man in the Kremlin. And so I think this is the biggest difference from the other wars I was covering, because, you know, in Afghanistan, let's face it, the Taliban, for all the horrible things they have done, they were represented, you know, a significant part of the Afghan people, not in the majority, but they had genuine support. Mm. And the government that the U.S. had been backing for 20 years almost was corrupt in many ways and not really interested in the well-being of the Afghan people in many cases as well. And so it was a conflict between different groups of Afghans in which the U.S. military was caught in. And we can make the same case about Iraq as well, to a different extent. There were many shades of gray there that were not really there. I'm not really there in Ukraine. There is no significant part of Ukrainians that is backing the Russians, certainly not in a military way. And as for the nature of covering it, obviously, because I was born in Ukraine and grew up there as a child, I did feel a mission to go and see and report on things, because I felt I was more equipped because I spoke the language, just I understood the culture, to narrate and relay the events on the front lines than, you know, people who weren't from there. And so I took more risks and went further than I would have otherwise sometimes. And, you know, it's more dangerous in Ukraine. It was definitely more dangerous than in Afghanistan and Iraq, because in those countries, I was not on the wrong end of an enemy air force or enemy artillery. And death can really get you anywhere in Ukraine. You know, the Russians have a habit of striking with missiles hotels where journalists stay, for example, you know, hundreds of miles from the front line. I think 7 of the hotels where I stayed had been bombed since then.
Mm. You think that's intentional?
Yeah, definitely. They don't want any observers of what's going on.
Mm.
I mean, they don't want people to know what's going on. And, you know, we go back to the, for example, you know, the history of Mariupol. There was one international news crew there, and my colleagues from the Associated Press, you know, 3 Ukrainian journalists. So once they left, about a month into the siege, there was only one other observer left there, a Lithuanian documentary filmmaker. So when the Russians stopped him at a checkpoint, they took him away. Then his wife found his body with a hole in his head, a bullet hole in his head, in the trash heap.
Hmm. So, what, as far as the Russian conduct in the war, is it, you know, is it just straightforwardly a litany of war crimes? I mean, I understand you and many rational people consider the war itself unjust. So, I guess the whole thing is a war crime on some level. But as far as, you know, how they've behaved in Ukraine, what do we know about that?
Well, I mean, we know of what they have done and what they could do, because they would have done much more if they could get away with it. And we've seen, going back to Mariupol was the one place where Russia had complete air superiority. So it could have unfettered use of its, you know, bomber planes and drop lots of dumb bombs on the city. And they flattened it. You know, they bombed, you know, maternity ward. They bombed a theater for all children that were hiding in the basement. And then they've bulldozed the buildings once they took over and to hide all the bodies. Nobody knows until now how many people died there.
Mm.
It was about 450,000 people in Mariupol before the war. And there was an AP investigation that found 10,000 freshly dug graves. That's for the people who were actually buried. Local officials estimate 30, 40, 50,000 people were killed there in 3 months. And fortunately for Ukraine, they couldn't do this in other places because Ukraine had air defenses and still has air defenses. But the Russians spent a whole winter trying to destroy the Ukrainian power and water infrastructure, openly saying, you know, we want to create epidemics in Kyiv, you know, so people die of diseases and flee to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They failed, thankfully, because of Ukraine's ability to protect its skies. But that ability is highly dependent on continuing American aid. The Ukraine is running out of interceptors now, so the Russians could still do it. And there are a whole lot of crimes, you know, because the whole idea of Ukrainians as a separate entity is, you know, is illegitimate in Russian eyes, then the entire war has, in fact, the genocidal nature because, you know, you have seen the International Criminal Court indicting, you know, President Putin and the Russian Ombudswoman for Children's Rights for the forcible policy to steal Ukrainian children and trace them as Russians.
Mm. And the numbers there are extraordinary. Isn't something like 700,000 children have been taken into Russia?
Yeah, I mean, nobody knows for sure. I don't think it's that much, but it's certainly a large number. But we also have seen Dmitry Medvedev, you know, who's the head of Russia's ruling party, the former president, being very open about the Russian goals in Ukraine. In January, he said that the very existence of Ukraine as a country, independent country, no matter how friendly to Russia, will not be acceptable to us. And sooner or later, in 5 or 50 years, it will be wiped out. And so Ukrainians have a choice, become Russians or to die. And because, you know, they don't want to see themselves and their loved ones killed by us, they will make the right choice. Mm. These are the words of a very senior Russian official, potential successor to Putin. So this is what the Russians want. It's not about NATO.
It's just hard to imagine that anyone in Russia believes, you know, including Putin, that anyone is aspiring to invade Russia from Ukraine or anywhere else, right? The defensive argument for, you know, needing Ukraine as a buffer between their European adversaries, I just don't understand how that makes sense.
It doesn't at all. It doesn't at all. But, you know, what is important is to look at the, and you were speaking about the Orthodox Church, but I think the real religion in Russia is not that. The real religion in Russia is the cult of victory in World War II. And it wasn't like that in Soviet times. It wasn't like that when I was growing up. It was really manufactured in the last 20 years.
Mm.
And you have these new traditions. You have this sort of immortal regiment where people go out with portraits of their ancestors who fought the Germans and, you know, carry them in the streets like icons. And, you know, all these children, you know, plays and ceremonies reenacting, you know, the sacrifices of the war, and they all dress up as little soldiers and die in the fire. And so the Russian public, the Russian new generation has been raised with this idea that, you know, one day we'll have to repeat the sacrifices of our great-great-grandfathers. And so now this time has come, and they're told, okay, well, you know, okay, time to die. And it's strange to the outsiders. So, you know, we have seen hundreds of thousands of Russian men who were killed or maimed in this war. And it's accepted as a natural sacrifice by the society. There's no protests, not much of an opposition. It's kind of okay.
Do we know roughly how many Ukrainians have died and how many Russians have died? And I guess how many Ukrainians have left the country? I mean, what are the numbers currently that you would put to both sides of the war?
So President Zelensky has officially announced 31,000 soldiers were killed. But this is just the number of soldiers whose deaths are confirmed and whose bodies were found. So there is an equal, maybe greater number not announced officially of missing in action, who are probably dead. So, you know, many tens of thousands. The same goes for civilian casualties. You know, the UN is publishing numbers. I think it's over 10,000, but it's only the numbers of people that they have been able to physically identify, and because they have no access to the occupied territories, places like Mariupol. So the many tens of others who were killed there are not accounted for. And, you know, for Russia, we have Western estimates of, you know, hundreds of thousands were killed or maimed, soldiers. You know, there are virtually no Russian civilian victims, obviously. And millions were displaced. 7 or 8 million people left the country, mostly women and children and older people, because men up until the age of 60 are not allowed to leave Ukraine because, you know, they are liable to be mobilized. Most of them aren't, but, you know, in case things deteriorate, they will be. And it's not clear how many of these refugees are still abroad, because great many people from Kyiv, for example, came back after a few months once the situation stabilized and the Russians were repulsed from around Kyiv. But what is clear is that, you know, there is not a single person in Ukraine whose life hasn't been upended one way or another, hasn't lost home, job, loved ones, friends, isn't fighting. So, and I think this is a trauma that will last for generations, especially in the Russian-speaking or historically Russian-speaking parts of eastern and southern Ukraine. And, you know, I'm talking in the book with the mayor of Kharkiv, the biggest Russian-speaking city in Ukraine. I was saying that in the past, we were quite loyal to Russia, but now it's 180 degrees because for us, the war is something that is very real. It's our homes that are being destroyed, our relatives being killed. Whereas for people in Western Ukraine that used to be seen as more into Russian, you know, war, fortunately for them, for now, is mostly something on television. And I think it's a very profound observation of this historical shift. And obviously, you know, these Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine are only Russian-speaking because of the history of colonization.
Mm-hmm.
And most Russian speakers in eastern and southern Ukraine had Ukrainian-speaking great-grandparents or grandparents, maybe even parents.
So tell me about the pace of U.S. aid to Ukraine and the degree to which it slowed and just the implications of that. I mean, where are we? Where were we and where are we? And what's at stake there?
Well, I mean, at stake is the survival of Ukraine, you know, because it needs ammo to fight. And right now, no one else has ammo. The Europeans are starting to make it, but it will take them time. But if we go back to the beginning, there are phases. In the very beginning, before the full-scale invasion, nobody wanted to give Ukraine much because A, everyone believed that it will collapse soon, and B, everyone had before their eyes the example of Afghanistan, where the Afghan army collapsed overnight. The Taliban were driving around in Humvees and MRAPs and even flying Black Hawks. And so the weapons that Ukraine received before the full-scale invasion from the U.S. were for a guerrilla war, sort of like Afghanistan-style campaign. Some anti-tank missiles, some Stingers, and sort of good luck waging an insurgency for the next 20 years. Then Ukraine repulsed the Russians using mostly Soviet-made or Soviet-designed weapons in its own stocks. And then it ran out of ammo for those around June, July 2022. And that's when American and then European artillery and then the HIMARS rocket systems and other weaponry started to trickle in. And I think every time it was too little too late, in part because of very successful Russian threats. Because, you know, President Putin on the day of the invasion announced that he will see the consequences of the kind you have never seen before if you interfere with this. And this nuclear blackmail was used very successfully to throttle Western aid to a point that he could stabilize the situation, reverse it, and then wait it out until now when, you know, the political process in the U.S. stopped it altogether. And, you know, the analogy I'm often hearing in Ukraine is that, yes, we have received a lot of aid at the end, but it's, you know, it's like you have a fire and you need a bucket of water to extinguish it. But nobody gave us a bucket. People kept giving us little cups over 2 years. And it all adds up to a bucket, but you can't extinguish fire, you know, with a little cup every few months.
Well, what do you think we, the Americans, I guess you could add the Europeans. I don't know if there's any daylight between us in this regard, but what do you think the West should have done in the face of Putin's nuclear threats? How should we respond to nuclear blackmail in a situation like this?
Well, I think the response was made eventually. You know, eventually, all the things that he was saying will be a red line were issued and the lines were crossed and they turned out to be non-existent. So, I mean, the correct policy would have been not to tie yourself up in self-imposed restraint. Because the problem with nuclear blackmail is this. If you invade a country and then say, well, you know, if you do something to stop me, I will use nukes, then what's next? Like, how will it be different if you invade Poland or Germany, right? You know, you have to call this blackmail early on, because otherwise it's, you know, it emboldens more and more blackmail.
I mean, I guess it depends on your theory of mind with respect to your enemy. I mean, so, you know, it matters whether you think Putin is totally insane or, you know, otherwise suicidal, right? Or, I mean, I think it would be, if we were dealing with a jihadist regime where we were pretty sure all their talk about paradise and loving death more than we love life was an honest confession of their worldview, that could change our sense of things.
You know, we have a crucial piece of evidence here. You know, his table.
Yeah.
In 2021, you know, somebody
the COVID
who
table.
Is exactly somebody who is suicidal.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't spend 2 years in isolation and, you know, have this, you know, biggest table in the world with his interlocutors.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that case, I just think, so assuming we're taking the other end of it where, you know, we imagine, I think rightly, that Putin is eager to survive and remain one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest man on earth, and live a good life in some sense. What do you think we should be doing now, even under the shadow of whatever nuclear threats he's making? I mean, what sort of help should we give Ukraine? Because you say we've crossed a bunch of his red lines. I'm sure there are ones we haven't crossed. I mean, we haven't given them everything we could give them, you know, short of, you know, American boots on the ground, what should we do?
Well, you know, if you ask the Ukrainians, obviously, the biggest disparity right now is in long-range fire capabilities. You know, the Russians are able to strike targets anywhere in Ukraine with the long-range missiles, and the Ukrainians are, A, prohibited from using foreign weapons to strike anything on Russian soil, which means that, you know, if there is an artillery battery firing at Kharkiv from Belgorod across the border, you cannot use American weapons to take it out. You just have to sit there and take the fire.
Hmm.
Or you cannot strike a Russian airfield from which they're flying the sources against Ukraine. So that's one restriction. And another restriction is that it's a partial red line because it's been broken by the UK and France, which have provided Ukraine with cruise missiles that they've used very successfully to take out Russian capabilities in Crimea, for example. But the US and Germany, which have their own, you know, the ATACMS and the Taurus missiles, have still not done that because that could be potentially seen as provocative by Russia, perhaps. So that's sort of going back to the administration. Obviously, the other big stumbling block, the biggest issue right now, is what's happening in Congress, where even though the Senate has voted to approve military aid for Ukraine with a 70-29 vote, a pretty big majority. You know, in the House, the Speaker refuses to put up legislation to a vote, even though it would have a majority there too. And that means ammunition. And, you know, Ukraine is running out, it's completely outgunned. Russia has, you know, 5-1, maybe 10-1 fire superiority, in part because North Korea very generously provided with more than 1 million shells. And that is already having impact on the ground. You know, Ukraine lost a city for the first time since May last year, city of Avdiivka, in February, because it didn't have enough shells to hold it, because the U.S. froze aid. You know, the delay, you know, it's been 4 months that the House has been sitting on the funding.
Mm. Why have Western sanctions not worked against Russia?
I wouldn't say they haven't worked. You know, they haven't worked sufficiently. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, they are porous. They're not being enforced. If you look at the Russian missiles and drones that are being shot down in Ukraine, they're full of Western components that are somehow getting to Russia through third countries, through the UAE, Turkey, you know, Kazakhstan, Georgia, China, you name it. Russia has found a market for its oil at a discount in places like India, which I'm all too happy to have cheap oil. And, you know, there is still Russian gas, you know, flowing to some countries in Europe. So the sanctions have been stronger than they were in 2014, but still quite limited.
Well, speaking of Russian gas, do we know what happened to the Nord Stream pipeline? Who blew it up?
Well, you know, there are many versions, and, you know, obviously the Russians are blaming the U.S., and the U.S. is not blaming the U.S., and all the countries that are investigating it, I think, prefer not to know.
But is there any, if you had to guess, what do you think the story is there?
It's hard to guess. You know, it's not that hard because the waters are quite shallow. Mm. So there could be a whole variety of actors.
Mm. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I had heard that, you know, not everyone could have done that. But was it within the capacity of Ukraine to blow it up?
Perhaps. Yes. I mean, some U.S. officials have told newspapers that they blame the Ukrainians.
Mm.
The Russians have laughed at that and said it's the U.S. trying to deflect blame. But I really don't have any hard data on who it was. Mm-hmm. I think the capacity to do that exists in many countries.
So where is all this heading? How do you think this war is going to end at this point? And I guess the inevitable question is, what would a Ukrainian loss mean here? And I guess there are probably different versions of it. There's the loss that it could just be a perpetual stalemate and a negotiated division of the country where, you know, Russia keeps whatever it currently has or some version of that. And I guess then there are worse losses that are conceivable. What do you think is possible here? Is a Ukrainian victory and, you know, reconquest of everything Russia took in the cards, conceivably, or just how do you broadcast us forward, you know, into the future here? And what is rational for the neighboring countries in Europe to fear? If Putin wins, you know, everything in Ukraine and reabsorbs it as a country, do you think he would continue attacking into Europe? Is that actually his state of mind, or do you think it's, you know, all he wants is Ukraine and then he's done?
Yeah. So let's start with the beginning. I think we're at a stage where everything is still possible. There's a whole range of possible outcomes here. And right now, the attrition battle, the attrition phase of the war, provided that the Western help continues, favors Ukraine. Russia is losing tanks, armored personnel carriers, artillery pieces, planes now, and definitely ships at a rate higher, much higher than it can build or refurbish. So, and analysts say that at current rate, in about 2 years, will run out of hardware and doesn't really have sources from which to replenish it. But that's provided that American and European aid continue and Ukraine gets resupplied with ammunition, which is now a big if. So on a different level, in this attrition phase, it's a war, it's a contest of resilience between the two societies. We've seen that Russia also has serious tensions under the surface. You know, last year, the Prigozhin uprising showed that sort of the toll that the strain of the war and the casualties are having on parts of the inner core Russian establishment. We don't know what else may be happening there. You know, as people in the intelligence community like to say, Russia is hard but brittle. But also in Ukraine, you know, we wouldn't know what may happen. You know, society is also under strain. And how resilient Ukraine is and society also depends on how much foreign support it continues to receive.
On that first point you made about Russian brittleness, I wanted to ask you, I'd heard that Putin perceives a failure in Ukraine to be a kind of existential threat to himself, right? That he can't afford to lose in Ukraine. Is that an exaggeration or is there some reason to believe that's the case?
I think it's probably true. And his fate is tied to the war now. Ending it at the current front lines would definitely mean a defeat strategically for Russia. And it's politically much safer for him to continue with the war than to end it, which is why, you know, if you ask Ukrainians or Russian dissidents, sort of Russian opposition politicians, they would tell you that any Russian politician, no matter how far right, you know, nationalist, extremist, you know, bloodthirsty cannibal he may be or she may be, is preferable to Putin because they would be able to say it's not our war and end it in a way that he just cannot. So yes, I mean Putin's fate is wedded to this war now. And so going back to your question about, you know, what next? So, you know, if we go back to the World War II analogy of wars of attrition, the front lines just like now didn't move for years. And, you know, the Ukrainian front line is pretty much static since November 2023 with a few small moves. And then suddenly the society collapsed in Russia and it moved. And then Germany collapsed and moved again. And so those things can happen quickly. And if you know, it's Ukraine that collapses, which seems unlikely right now, but absent foreign aid could happen, and Russia succeeds in taking over all of Ukraine, then, you know, I mean, Putin himself, you know, he compared himself to Peter the Great and, you know, called himself the collector of Russian lands. And he named one of these lands, Narva, which is a city in Estonia, you know, a member of NATO, a member of the European Union, as Russian land. So he's clearly indicated that his ambitions don't stop in Ukraine. And the pattern of Russian behavior was to use people of conquered lands as cannon fodder. So what happened in 2022, in January, was that pretty much every single military-aged male in Russian-controlled parts of Donbas was mobilized and sent to fight Ukrainians. And most of them died or were killed or injured since then. And he will obviously use surviving Ukrainian men to fight his next war, because they will be dispensable if he wins in Ukraine. And so I think there is a great realization now, much greater realization in Europe, in Germany, but also in France and in other countries, that what's at stake in Ukraine is not just Ukraine, but it's also the future of the European Union, the future of Europe, especially if the U.S., you know, elects President Trump again, and the American commitment to European security will become much more questionable.
Yeah. How do you view the prospect of a Trump presidency next year? Is that synonymous with a green light for Putin from the American side, or I mean, is it more muddled than that?
I think it's more muddled. And former President Trump, what did he say? He said that I have a peace plan, and in 24 hours I can achieve peace in Ukraine. But he also said, if the Russians don't accept it, I'll double down on aid for Ukraine. So he's leaving himself a lot of room for maneuver, and he also praised Zelensky as the great salesman. So the fact of the matter, if you look at it from the Ukrainian perspective, President Obama washed his hands off Ukraine, refused military aid, And it's under Trump that for the first time American weapons were supplied to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the record is complicated. And obviously, officials in Kyiv do hope that they can work with anyone who's in the White House, including Trump. But I think in Europe, there is, you know, a great sense of realization, panic, and understanding that, oh my God, we have wasted all this time, but the American umbrella may no longer be here soon. And we better get going to increase our own military production, fund our own militaries. And it may be too late because it takes time.
Yeah. What's the most optimistic time course for, you know, Europe to supply Ukraine with weapons of their own manufacture? I mean, is this a story of years rather than months?
Well, so the European Union was promising to supply Ukraine with 1 million artillery shells last year, only delivered about 300,000. Russia got more than 1 million from North Korea. This year, they should be able to supply 1 million shells, which is sort of enough for Ukraine to maintain defensive operations. That translates to about, you know, 3,000 shells a day or so, but definitely not enough for an offensive. Now, next year, if the U.S. production also rises, hopefully, you know, there will be more for Ukraine.
Does the United States have the stockpiles currently to just supply Ukraine immediately, or is it also a story of us having to produce shells and other weaponry that we don't currently have in supply?
I mean, the U.S. has stockpiles. The question is how much of the stockpiles could be drawn to help Ukraine, because obviously the U.S. military has to keep an eye on various other theaters of operation, and it has just resupplied Israel. So the $95 billion bill that was passed by the Senate and is not being put to a vote in the House by Speaker Johnson includes funding for increasing production in the U.S., especially production of ammunition. And, you know, the U.S. is already increasing it, but obviously, you know, it's not enough for U.S. needs and for Ukraine. Everybody's been very slow in increasing production because everybody was hoping that somehow, miraculously, this war won't last. I mean, the entire Western military establishment was premised on the idea that, you know, the wars we fight will be short and victorious, not lengthy and resource-consuming.
What can you say about the failure of messaging here? I'm speaking in particular in an American context. And again, I'm thinking more right of center, just that there's a very muddled message that is allowing for this kind of hand-wringing and pointless delay, right? It's just like it seems that no one can agree about the moral imperative of drawing the line here and holding it against Putin's naked war of aggression that has implications for all of Europe and really the, you know, the Western alliance. And to the contrary, there are many people who would take the opposite side of this and say, well, the clear moral line here is not to perpetuate the pointless loss of life in Ukraine by supplying them with more weaponry in a war that is by definition doomed, right? I mean, you have someone like Elon Musk, who has more responsibility in this theater than one would want because of the indispensable use of his Starlink technology, right? So it's, I mean, he's not nobody, and yet he says things like, you know, there's no way Russia isn't going to win this, and any prolongation of this war with our, quote, help is not helping at all because it's just leading to more death on both sides. What would moral clarity sound like right of center in America at the moment?
Well, I mean, Speaker Johnson had the moral clarity in October when he was elected. He said very clearly, you know, we will not abandon Ukraine. And I understand that if Putin wins in Ukraine, he will not stop there. I mean, he hasn't acted on these words, but, you know, he did say them. Now, you know, there is this magical thinking somehow that, oh, well, if we stop giving weapons to Ukrainians, people will stop dying and the war will end through some kind of magical solution. But there's no evidence that Russia wants to stop the war or have some kind of deal that in short of taking over all of Ukraine. And so stopping the weapons just means more and more Ukrainians will die, civilians who will not be protected by air defense, whose cities will be flattened, like Mariupol, soldiers who will be dying under Russian shelling and unable to respond, hundreds of thousands of more people will die, maybe millions, if the weapons are cut off, And the Ukrainians will keep resisting because they know from the history what it means to be under Russian rule. And they know from, you know, Russian very open pronouncements of what they will do to Ukrainians if they take Kyiv and other cities. The Russian blueprint is clear. You know, it's been published in official Russian media, you know, all those articles, what shall we do with Ukraine? And it says we have to physically liquidate the elites, just the Russian, like the Russians did in the 1930s. So mass executions of intellectuals, writers, politicians. And then we have to re-educate their children and make them Russians. So The history of Ukraine is so replete with tragedies under Russian colonialism that people will just keep resisting, even if they don't have weapons.
Well, Yaroslav, this has been a wonderful primer on the war, and I think it'll be incredibly useful for people to hear. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for the work you've done in this and other wars. It's really, it's amazing reporting. And again, I recommend your book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, for much more coverage on just what has happened there. Stay safe, Yaroslav.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.